It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, an education professor from UW-Platteville spent his sabbatical helping Syrian refugees in Germany. We'll find out what he learned during his 6 months of volunteer work among the thousands of refugees awaiting asylum.
First, reports are saying that a poison gas attack killed dozens of people, including children, in the Syrian province of Idlib today. The New York Times is reporting that it was the deadliest chemical attack in years.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer attributed the attack to the Syrian government and called it, quote, reprehensible and something that cannot be ignored by the civilized world. Spicer was also critical of Obama-era policy on Syria in his remarks and said President Trump was speaking with his national security team.
Jeremy Suri joins us now to tell us more about the White House's approach to the conflict in Syria. He's a professor in the Department of History and holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now, the White House is attributing this attack to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Is that coming as a surprise to you at all?
Well, it is a surprise to me, the boldness of this attack. There have been a number of reports in recent months of Assad's government forces using chlorine gas to control and kill pockets of population. But this seems like a very, very bold, obvious and undeniable mass killing. And it doesn't surprise me that Assad would want to do that, but it surprises me that he felt he could get away with that.
And what about Russia and Iran's reaction here?
Well, the Russians and Iranians, as far as I can tell, have not said very much about this. They have not even confirmed that this happened, and they certainly are not taking on any responsibility. But, of course, they have been Assad's defenders, and it is the Russians who brokered the removal of other chemical weapons from Syria and also brokered the ceasefire. So they have a certain responsibility for the general setting here and for control over the situation, and we haven't heard much from them.
Sean Spicer, Press Secretary Sean Spicer, was immediately critical of the Obama administration's policy towards Syria, and he called it weak. Can you give us an overview of how Obama approached the Syrian conflict?
Well, let me just say one other thing first, if I might, Kate. I mean, it's horrible when a large number of people have been killed that the first reaction by anyone is to blame their political opponent. That's reprehensible, morally outrageous, and I would say that if it were a Democratic press secretary who said that. So let's first get that out of the way. We should be talking about the people who died here and the tragedy and how we can save lives, not pointing fingers. The Obama administration's policy was to try to deter and discourage Bashar Assad from using chemical weapons. When he did that anyway, when he used the weapons anyway and crossed the so-called red line, as President Obama had announced it, Obama hesitated to use force against Assad and instead went into a deal that the Russians negotiated for the weapons to be removed by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is a non-governmental organization that won the Nobel Peace Prize. The hope was that the weapons would be removed and not used again. Clearly, that wasn't the case, as we've seen today.
Yeah, because the last attack that killed more than 1,000 people was in 2013 near Damascus.
Correct, correct. So we've had a good 4 years without a major attack. But as I said, there have been reports, credible reports, though I don't know if they're absolutely true or not, of the use of chlorine gas by Assad's forces in previous months. And there have been allegations that all of the weapons, the chemical weapons, had not been removed as promised after 2013.
And medical workers in the area are saying that this attack is different. It's likely that the attack perhaps used banned toxins. Do we know anything more about this?
Well, I'm not an expert, but I do know that this is a nerve agent and that the idea is to create a disruption to the nerve, one's nervous system. This is the sort of evidence that has come forth already of people having frothing from the mouth and various other internal reactions. And I think this is a kind of weapon that can kill more people with smaller amounts. That's what makes it really scary.
The Trump administration said earlier that their policy towards Syria was not regime change. What has the approach been in President Trump's early days here in office?
Well, as far as we can tell, and this is, makes it further ironic that they seem to want to point fingers at their predecessor, as far as we can tell, they've done nothing different from President Obama. They have jumped up and down and said nasty things about ISIS, but everyone was saying nasty things about ISIS. But they've continued to work with the Russians, as Obama was. In fact, they seem to be working more closely with the Russians. And Obama was not doing anything to indicate or create regime change. He had talked about it years ago. So the policy has looked pretty much the same. It's still early, but there's no evidence of any different strategy, or any different plan, any different tactics that the Trump administration has.
We're talking right now with Jeremy Suri. He's a professor in the Department of History and holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. We're talking about a chemical weapons attack in Syria where dozens have been reported killed. We know that hundreds have been injured. Jeremy, the UN Security Council has called an emergency meeting. It's going to be happening tomorrow. And the UN office responding for chemical weapons is reportedly investigating this. Do you think the UN Security Council, which is, of course, U.S. is a permanent member of, could have any influence in preventing further chemical attacks?
Well, one influence they can have, of course, is to get the information out and to prevent lies about it. And so people know this is happening and hopefully can put all kinds of pressure on Assad and maybe embarrass the Russians. But it's going to be very hard for the Security Council to do anything substantive because the Russians have a veto on the Security Council, and they are Assad's big protectors. So I'm not even sure the Trump administration would want to go to do something that the Russians wouldn't want to do. But even if it did, it's hard to imagine the Russians going for that. So I think it's going to be about public shaming and making sure people at least know the horror that's occurring here.
What have we heard from top administration officials like Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley?
As far as I can tell, not much of anything. It's still soon. They're still trying to figure out, I guess, what's happened. But as far as I know, the main comments have come from Sean Spicer, who I think you quoted before. But I would expect that certainly in the UN context, we'll get a statement from Nikki Haley. In general, Secretary of State Tillerson has been slow to make public comments since he's come to office. So I don't know if he'll make a statement or not.
Republican John McCain has been critical of President Trump's foreign policy, and he's been calling for pushing for the removal of the Assad regime. Does it look like other Republicans might push the Trump administration to look at U.S. involvement in Syria in a different light?
Well, I think what we're going to get will be a lot of, many Republicans who will reiterate what they said when Obama was president, which is that we look weak. And this is a threat to our interests when chemical weapons are being used because, of course, the use of them in one place opens the door for them to being used somewhere else. And they could be used against our soldiers in that region or elsewhere. So I think there will be criticism if the Trump administration doesn't do more, do something different from what Obama did. But I also think that with the exception of Senator McCain and a few others, very few members of Congress are desirous of sending American forces on the ground. So I think you'll hear calls for bombing and sanctions and things of that sort, but you won't hear calls for ground troops. Where this will be a problem for the Trump administration is, as everyone knows, there are serious concerns about the Trump administration's close relationship with Russia. And if the Trump administration does not take a strong stance against what Assad has done, this will be seen as one more piece of evidence of American Trump administration collusion with Russia, and that will be a problem for Trump.
And finally, we're hearing signs that this might be a war crime. From an international law standpoint, what could a chemical weapons attack carried out by a government forces, what could that mean?
So a war crime, if what has occurred is what you just described, that would be a war crime, or certainly would be prosecutable as a war crime, because a war crime is an intentional, brutal, unnecessary, disproportionate attack upon civilians, and that's what this would be. There is no case where I can think of where a use of chemical weapons on an undefended population would be justified under legal or proportional sanction. So this would be subject to a war crimes tribunal. It would be subjected to trial in the Hague. And what this would mean practically is that citizens or those close to Assad, anyone associated with this attack, could be arrested and tried if they leave Syria.
Do you have any idea what the White House's next steps might be?
I think they're in a tough position, and I think you're going to see different points of view. You're going to, from the NSC, from NSC advisor H.R. McMaster, and from Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, you're going to hear calls for a strong condemnation and possibly increased sanctions and even limited military activities. But I think you're going to get a pushback from President Trump and Bannon and Kushner and others, and you're going to see an internal debate on this. In the short run, you'll see more condemnations of Assad, but they won't know what to do, and there'll be days of uncertainty. So far, they've been pretty unorganized in their foreign policy, and I expect to see more disorganization and more contradiction in the next few days.
Jeremy, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That was Jeremy Suri. He joined us today to talk about the White House's response to a deadly gas attack that killed dozens in Syria today. It was the first major atrocity blamed on the Syrian government since President Trump took office.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we find out why pit bulls have been seen as everything from wonderful family dogs to vicious fighters over the years.
Right now, a University of Wisconsin-Platteville education professor is back from his six-month sabbatical working with Syrian refugees who are awaiting asylum in Germany. More than 10,000 refugees are housed at two former U.S. military bases in Darmstadt, a city near Frankfurt. Over the past 2 years, more than a million refugees have found their way to Germany, many of them fleeing the Syrian civil war.
Dan Leach joins us now. He's an associate professor in the School of Education at UW-Platteville. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate, and thanks for letting me share my story.
Yeah, so you were in Germany from last August up to this February. Tell us what you were doing there.
Well, I did two things. First of all, I had the opportunity to teach at Darmstadt University of Applied Sciences, and I also had the opportunity to volunteer with an organization called Helping Hands, which is a self-help organization for refugees.
Yeah, and what is that organization trying to do?
Well, it's actually refugees helping refugees. So they have 17 volunteers. They are themselves asylum seekers, and they connect with newcomers and help them learn the ropes in the community and get them through their paperwork and otherwise just support them in their transition.
And explain the situation in Darmstadt and where these refugees are, what their conditions are like, and what their day-to-day lives are like for them.
Well, Darmstadt's a city about the size of Madison, and it's the home of the European Space Agency, so it's a high-tech city that also has two major universities. The refugees are currently housed in primarily in two military bases. They're former U.S. military bases, and I would say there's between 10 and 20,000 refugees in those, and they've also converted a few hotels into accommodations for refugees. So it's rather impressive that they're able to get so many refugees safely under shelter and give them food, clothing, and basic supplies.
And what were your interactions like with them?
Well, it's not just one group. When you say refugees, there's a lot of different nationalities, ethnicities, and languages in there.
Yeah.
So there is actually 12 different language groups in the one program. It was a converted hotel with about 450 individuals, 12 different language groups. And I primarily had the opportunity to work with the peer mentors or the volunteers that help other refugees.
And you found that you were able to learn some things that you can teach your students about how they should approach dealing with children of immigrants and children of refugees in their own classrooms. What did you bring back?
Well, you know, the big thing I brought back was that people aren't defined by this term refugee. It's actually just, you know, a legal term that's applied to them during this one period in their life, you know, really one of the most difficult periods. But when you deal with them, they're surprisingly just like us. You know, they had normal lives before the war in Syria. Many of them were just shopkeepers, accountants, computer guys, young families. And, of course, they've experienced this trauma of being uprooted and forced to leave. So on one hand, they're not different from us, but on the other hand, when students are working with them in schools or a social worker is working with them, they have to recognize that they have undergone a severe amount of trauma, and they might be in need of trauma-based care.
We're talking right now with Dan Leach. He's an associate professor in the School of Education at UW-Platteville. And during his recent sabbatical, he went to Germany and he worked with refugees there who are awaiting asylum. Dan, you know, sometimes we are so far removed from the migrant crisis, from the refugee crisis. What can Americans do to be more engaged in this or to help in their own communities?
Well, that's a good question, Kate. First of all, Americans can stay informed, which of course is what your listeners are doing today. If someone wants to help, I would encourage them to research some relief organizations that are doing some good work. Specifically, the most difficult time for the refugees happens during the transit. Germany is the destination country, but they often travel through Greece, Italy, Croatia, and on to Germany, and it's during this time that they need the most help. I did a little research on organizations that are helping. One of them is Samaritan's Purse, and they provide things like cell phones and prepaid credit cards to some of the most vulnerable refugees, such as women traveling with children.
And how did you find that the children are holding up mentally with all of this? Could you detect their stress?
Definitely the children are traumatized by the experience. Some of them have lost family members, especially during the dangerous boat ride across the Mediterranean. Last year, approximately 3,700 people were killed during transit. I felt confident that they were receiving a high level of care from the German social workers and psychologists, and they're holding up pretty good.
And do you think there are some takeaways that we could learn from Germany about how Germany is approaching the refugee crisis and how they are handling refugees?
One of the things I was really impressed with was the ability of small towns to accommodate refugees and to come together and really welcome them, and the tremendous number of volunteers who would step forward and teach them German, for example, or help them with paperwork. I think we have a tremendous potential in this country to do the same.
And how much do they know about the politics of the refugee crisis and their asylum standing in Germany? How in tune are they with the politics that's going on around them?
They are very in tune. As a matter of fact, that is probably the primary topic of conversation is the politics of the EU, the politics of Germany, and also they're intensely interested in the politics of the United States.
Did you find if they had any feelings about President Trump?
Well, actually, he's not the most popular guy in Germany, believe it or not. And the refugees weren't concerned so much that they wouldn't be able to come to the United States, but that the rest of the world was going to take the cue from the United States in their policies towards refugees.
And Dan, how have you been changed by your sabbatical and being among the refugees for 6 months?
Well, Kate, I really was opened up to the fact that refugees aren't that much different than us. And as a matter of fact, to see individuals that have lost everything and yet still be able to reach out and help their fellow refugees in any way they can, that was a bit inspiring for me and humbling.
Do you find any glimmers of hope that you took away from Germany?
I did. It seems overwhelming at times. The numbers last year, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that 60 million people were on the move, displaced and internally in their countries or refugees. But yet, when I was in Germany, I was able to see that even small towns, people were doing whatever they could to welcome the refugees and to integrate them into their communities.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. I appreciated the opportunity.
Dan Leach is an associate professor in the School of Education at UW-Platteville.
Coming up after the news, are pit bulls beasts, best friends, or just ordinary dogs? I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the annual State of the Tribes address was delivered to the Wisconsin legislature this afternoon. We'll get analysis from two guests.
First, you might not know it today, but pit bulls were once America's favorite dog, the pet of choice for presidents, families, and TV shows. Who wanted a dog with friendliness and personality.
But the lineage of pit bulls as a fighting dog took root in the American mind, and the dogs have been seen since as menacing, dangerous, and hardwired to fight over the years. Our next guest looks at the history of pit bulls and tries to separate fact from fiction. Bronwyn Dickey joins us now. She's a contributing editor at Oxford American and the author of the book Pit Bull, The Battle Over an American Icon. Bronwyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Bronwyn, why have pit bulls been such a focal point for extremes over the years? The love and the hate and the demonizing, and then on the other hand, what you say is overprotection sometimes.
Well, I think first, probably because the dog itself is a little bit generic as dogs go. It's medium-sized, short-coated, and it's been used for all kinds of things by all kinds of people over the years. So there have always been a lot of them. And typically they've also been very working class, kind of blue collar dogs. So even back into the 17th century, there were people who were saying, oh, those are the dogs for people on the wrong side of town, et cetera, et cetera. And then you had people who really loved them and said, no, these are our family dogs. They're wonderful. So I think part of it really is that the dogs are kind of an inkblot test for whatever we humans want to project onto them.
And when we use the term pit bull, is it clear what dog we're talking about? Because it sounds like the term pit bull is generically applied to maybe three different actual breeds of dogs, not to mention mixed breeds.
Right. That's the stickiest part of this whole thing. is that the term pit bull has kind of morphed over the years to include pretty much anything anybody wants it to be, whether it's a dog with a blocky head or a dog with a brindle coat. But within that category, which I'm always careful to say, you know, pit bull is not a breed, just like hound is not a breed. It's a type. So it's a category, kind of like a bucket of different breeds of dog. But there, in the book, I define it as four specific breeds: the American Pit Bull Terrier, the American Staffordshire Terrier, the Staffordshire Bull Terrier, and a relatively new breed called the American Bully. But yeah, the big problem is that people kind of lump all these mixed breeds that may or may not have any kind of pit bull DNA in them into that category as well, which makes the statistics on things like bites pretty worthless.
And you adopted a pit bull, part of the impetus to launch you on this journey. What kind of things did you hear from people, friends and family, when you told them you were going to adopt this pit bull?
Yeah, it was one of the reasons that I knew I had kind of something more interesting than just an article in my hands was when my husband and I did adopt this dog, this, you know, totally normal shelter dog named Nola, from our local shelter. And because she bore this label called Pit Bull, people in our lives felt free to weigh in on the choice we had made and kind of comment on it in a way I don't think they would have if she had been any other kind of dog. So one female friend said, you know, I wouldn't do that. Those dogs will turn on you. My own mother claimed I must have a death wish. I mean, it was just this bizarre kind of maelstrom of commentary from the people in our lives, when really this was just, you know, a family dog who was perfectly lovely. So I realized that people's reactions to these dogs was a story in and of itself.
Well, you say family dog, and it's interesting because now, the image of the pit bull, I think, is being a little resurrected right now. But for a long time, it was as this fighting dog. But if we go back earlier than that, it sounds as though there were a couple of presidents who loved their pit bulls. This was the dog and the little rascals that trailed around. Right now, Patrick Stewart has a pit bull. He's not from that era, but I mean, there were these instances where society kind of loved pit bulls.
Oh, absolutely. In the Spanish-American War, by far the most common dog that was a mascot for both the Army and Navy was a little pit bull, because again, they're just kind of small and easy to, you know, they're just kind of pal around dogs. Or that's the way they were seen in that era. Gary Cooper had a pit bull, Helen Keller, you know, tons and tons of Teddy Roosevelt, tons of people loved these dogs. And so it wasn't just about their, quote, fighting reputation, though that has been with them, you know, since the beginning for a very long time. But they were seen, especially during the Depression, as kind of the dog for the average Joe, the dog with the patch over his eye, that was unfussy and just kind of an all-around sidekick for the average person. And that's what was so kind of enticing and wonderful about them. And then when you see kind of people get more fascinated by pure breeds later on, especially in the 1950s, there was a big, big, big boom after the war when people had lots more money. Then kind of the AKC breed registration thing took off. And the kind of generic dog with a patch over his eye wasn't as much fun anymore.
We're talking with Bronwyn Dickey right now, contributing editor at Oxford American, and the author of the book we're discussing today. It's called Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. And let's go back to that reputation that is still clinging today, this version of pit bulls as being sort of hardwired to fight, as being bred to be fighting dogs. Is there truth there?
Well, I mean, there's some truth to anything if you kind of parse it enough, in that the American Pit Bull Terrier, kind of the central core breed of this group, was developed in 1889 specifically as a fighting dog in Massachusetts. But the caveat there is that breeding for fighting is very hard to do. It isn't like breeding for retrieving or pointing, something that, you know, like helps the dog secure food for itself. Dogs are social creatures. So breeding a dog that does not want to live with other dogs or can't tolerate other dogs, you're pushing the evolutionary boulder up the hill. So historical estimates place the number of purpose-bred pit bulls that could actually do that grim work of combat as between 1 and 10%. And the rest, the washouts, were just, as I said, these kind of generic farm dogs, some of them, family dogs, plenty of the others of them. So yes, while today there are still certain lines of dog that are bred for that purpose, they are vanishingly small compared to how many dogs that look this way are out there. The biggest thing most of these dogs have in common today is that, like most other dogs in America, they're bred for how they look. So people are purchasing them because they are attracted to the look. They like the kind of stocky, big-headed, sometimes imposing pit bull look, but they aren't necessarily being selected for those behaviors.
Well, and you wonder if other dogs might have members among them, let's say just Shetland sheepdogs, for instance. Maybe as a whole, the temperament of the breed is supposed to be kind of mild-mannered and quiet, but what if you get a really scrappy Shetland sheepdog? I mean, that dog perhaps could be a fighter too. Do we know whether those fighters among pit bulls, those numbers are any higher than for any other breed?
I mean, there hasn't been any kind of peer-reviewed research on that, but I mean, I guess it would be likelier since there are certain lines of this particular dog that are still used for that purpose. But I think part of what was kind of a mixed bag about a lot of the awareness campaigns of the 90s and early 2000s, and then finally the Michael Vick case, was that it gave this perception that dog fighting was absolutely everywhere, and that pit bulls were only involved in dog fighting. And somehow everything about their narrative had to come back to dog fighting somehow. You had people claiming that if a pit bull was nice, you know, it must be some kind of bait dog in a dog fighting operation. And that's just not true. I mean, and that's never been true. Most of these dogs, like most dogs in America, just fall into the same kind of bell curve where you have the really abnormally tolerant ones on one end and the really abnormally intolerant ones way at the other end. But most in the middle are just trying to get through the day like the rest of us.
And you write about what has happened to the breed, especially during things like breed bans in cities. What has the breed, or the generic term, what have pit bulls gone through? As you know, as a society, we might have been kind of upset and fearful about them.
Right. Well, after certain, kind of like anything else in the media, after you have a really horrible incident and that gets amplified nationally and sometimes internationally, it's understandable that people would be fearful. So especially in the 1980s, there was this kind of, in the book I describe it as a moral panic that traced to a few incidents that were then amplified on a global scale, where, you know, someone might have been injured or died, and which is a horrible, horrible tragedy. But all the news coverage gave the impression that these things were happening all the time, when in fact they weren't. So as a result of that, you actually had this period of kind of witch hunt type persecution, where especially following the summer of 1987, you had dogs being, you know, firebombed with Molotov cocktails, dogs being hanged, families turning in their dogs to the shelters because they were afraid that their neighbors would somehow take their rage out on the animals, that kind of thing. And for many years, these dogs were not able to be adopted out from any animal shelter at all. They were euthanized on site. So add to that, in Miami and Denver, two cities that have had citywide breed bans, where basically pit bulls, especially in Denver, have been rounded up and euthanized. And that's a pretty scary scenario. And I think now we're kind of understanding that was a drastic overreaction, when in fact, to solve the problems of bites and very rare tragedies of deaths, we really needed to be looking at human-dog interactions, not just looking at the dog.
Bronwyn Dickey is with us right now. She's a contributing editor at Oxford American and a contributor at other publications, and the author of the new book called Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon.
And we want to hear from you. Do you own a pitbull? Do you think they've been treated fairly? Or do you think there's a reason to mistrust pitbulls? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And Bronwyn Dickey stays with us now as we discuss her new book called Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think why we have such mixed feelings over pit bulls? Do you own a pit bull? What's your experience been like? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Ron, I want to ask you about one of the topics you get to in the book, which I think is pretty compelling. You say that for not just pit bulls, not just the dogs, but for the people who own the dogs, that you think that as a society, we have moved them outside of the circle of compassion and they're seen as other and not as worthy, both the people and the dogs. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And that was by far the most illuminating part of this process for me, was seeing how much the history of our own prejudices and our own kind of social inequalities played into the history of these dogs. As you say, not only are the dogs kind of branded as other, in that even in medical studies, there are studies that divide dogs called pit bulls into one category and then all other dogs into another. Same thing with news headlines. If there's a bad story, you know, someone gets bitten, it's a pit bull bite. Whereas if it's any other type of dog, then it's just a dog bite. These are not domestic dogs that have been with us for many hundreds of years. But also in terms of how we see the kind of people who are attracted to these dogs, who take these dogs in, who have built their lives around these dogs. For a period in the early 2000s, when no pit bulls were allowed to be adopted out of shelters, I have some, you know, quotes from several shelter workers from that period when they say, you should see the type of person that wants a pit bull. They're just disgusting. Or, you know, the very fact of wanting a pit bull means that something's wrong with you. And I think we've come a long way since then, but I think we need to understand that dogs are so woven into the fabric of our lives that it's very easy for us to kind of project our own prejudices and fears and hang-ups and tribalism onto them. And it's very hard to know where the dog ends and where we begin sometimes.
I want to get to our callers now. We've got Colette on the line with us, calling from Lac des Flambeaux. Colette, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say I've had the American Pit Bull Terrier for 36 years, and my first dog I got in Minnesota, and I spent the next 8 years fighting the bans on the dogs. I got the first bill passed statewide in the state of Minnesota that keeps any town from prohibiting by breed. And since that time, you know, I've continually had the American Pit Bull Terriers. Currently, I have one that a lot of people just gravitate towards. The color is defined as blue. It's a gray color, and he's a shorter, stocky. And I'm just always amazed at the number of people that come up and pet him, and he's a very happy boy. And then I tell people what he is, and they're just totally astounded. It's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know this was a pit bull.
Colette, do you think that some of the apprehension that as a society we've had about pit bulls, is it starting to wane, or do you think that it's still there?
Well, I think it is still there. But I'm seeing so many more of the dogs all across the country. You know, I try to be a good ambassador, and my dog before I was taking into veteran centers, and he was a certified therapy dog that came from a rescue in Albany, New York. But what I'm seeing is if people try to bring the dog into normal situations and educate people, it does help.
All right. Thank you, Colette. A lot of perspective there. Colette has spent a long time working with pit bulls and with legislation surrounding pit bulls, too. And, Bronwyn, is that typical sometimes when people find, maybe discover this kind of dog that they love, they happen to be pit bulls, that they do get involved, maybe even on the level that Colette was?
Yeah, I think that's fairly common, at least as an interest, if not people who go out and do as much work as she did, which is wonderful. When you have something that you love very much, everyone thinks the thing they love is special. And so when you find that it's been persecuted in this way, I think a lot of people are very motivated to get into that kind of activism. But also something else she said really kind of struck a chord with me when she said how many people gravitate toward her dog. One of the things that really surprised me in this process was how positive people were, just people out on the street, how either neutral or positive they were about these dogs. I expected to kind of, from the media stories, that pit things, not to coin a phrase, but that kind of make things half and half. I expected to get half people who loved the dogs and half people who didn't. And I could count on one hand the people I talked to who really had a very strong negative reaction. Just when I was out and about, you know, pulling random strangers off the street and saying, what do you think about pit bulls? Most people, either they didn't know, they hadn't had any experience with them, and they were a little wary maybe, or they were very positive, saying, oh, you know, I'm glad that people are giving the dogs a chance. So I think that the kind of the way America feels about the dog is a lot more positive than sometimes we're led to believe. I think they're really coming around and seeing that really all dogs are truly unique and individual.
Colette, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to move next to Tara in Madison. Tara, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate the things that you had to say and the thought that you put behind the history of the breed and sort of the changes that have gone on and thinking about the breed and its role in the community. I think that right now perhaps we're in a position where the pendulum has swung from one extreme to almost the other in terms of how society views these dogs. I've been a breeder of a different breed for a number of years, and it's a large breed that I always need to make sure that I'm thinking about how best to train it, how best to represent it in public, the type of people that would be appropriate to own this breed and how to mentor them in making sure that the dog is successful and integrated into a family and into a community. And I think that we need to do the same thing with pit bulls. There are statistics out there that show that there are problems with the pit bulls, and I don't know that it's the breed itself so much as perhaps people's desire to believe that all dogs are absolutely wonderful and we need to just shower them with love. And sometimes that doesn't work in a particular breed or in a particular individual animal in a breed. These are a dog that are larger, and they can cause damage to people when they aren't managed properly.
Tara, thank you for that phone call. And briefly, yeah. Bronwyn, what do you say to that? She's talking about different management techniques for different breeds.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in what she said that I would completely agree with, in that you know, when something becomes kind of a cause celeb, you'll always have a number of people who see it, you know, if there's completely black on one side, then other people want to see it completely white. So I have certainly spoken to people over the course of this research who, you know, felt so strongly about kind of the cause of pit bulls that they did not want to admit that genetics play any role in dog behavior, which, of course, any behaviorist would tell you is just not true. In any human or animal or any creature, genes and environment are always working together. So we need to respect that and understand it. As far as, you know, statistics showing certain breeds being problematic, again, I would caution against putting too much weight behind those, because we really don't know which dogs are being defined as pit bulls. You know, it would be like if you're kind of comparing specific makes and models of cars, like the Toyota Corolla or the Ford Expedition, to all sedans or all SUVs.
And we're out of time. We have to leave it there, Bronwyn. It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. Thanks
that was Bronwyn Dickey, contributing editor at Oxford American and the author of the new book, Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. And we'd love to hear from you. You can still keep the conversation going. Let us know what you're thinking, your experience with pit bulls. If you're a landlord, any thoughts there? You can let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page.
The state assembly is voting on something that you might surprise you today, whether or not to make cheese the official state dairy product.
I guess for me, the surprise is I sort of thought maybe it already was that, but it's an oversight maybe, I guess. And the move in this case was driven by a request from fourth graders in Mineral Point.
And California now produces the most milk, but Wisconsin is the number one cheese producer in the country.
And it better stay that way. And Wisconsin is also the number one producer, especially of mozzarella cheese for pizzas in the country. So I would say that the country owes Wisconsin a great debt.
It was like a no-brainer. These fourth graders saw an oversight.
We need fourth graders looking at more legislation.
Exactly.
What do we need? What did we miss? This could be the secret to make politics work.
It's definitely needs to be in the law.
And Kate, you're relatively new to Wisconsin. Have you branched out, tried any exciting new Wisconsin-made cheeses yet?
I try to close my eyes in the grocery store and just pick one, but I had some with dill recently, and I just love dill. So any cheese with dill in it, I'm game.
I'm on board with the dill as well, and cheese, and cheese curds especially. Have you tried those?
Yes, cheese curds, yes, and I'm waiting for state fair season.
Well, you've just begun your cheese journey.
Journey.
You're listening to Central Time.